Welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. I'm Rachel Isaacs, a Pardes student from Manalapa, New Jersey, and the engineer for this program. Today we are joined by Rabbi Meir Schweiger, who is the Mashkiach Ruchani, spiritual guide at Pardes. He will be teaching us about Parshat Vayetze. A couple of brief announcements, and then we'll turn it over to Rabbi Schweiger. Interested in Jewish education? Want to serve the North American Jewish community by teaching at Jewish day schools? Check out the Pardes Educators Program, which combines Pardes learning with a master's degree. Pardes provides its students with the opportunity to delve into primary Jewish texts, studied in Chavruta in our vibrant Beit Midrash. The program is fully funded by the Avichai Foundation. For more information, check out our website at www.pardes.org.il. That's it, and now Rabbi Schweiger.
Thank you, Rachel. This week's parsha is Parshat Vayetze. And if last week we spoke about the story of Yitzchak, in this week, we begin the story of Yaakov. The first sentence in the parsha says, "Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Shava, vayelech Harana." Yaakov left Be'er Shava and he goes to Haran. And the question immediately arises, why does the Torah have to tell me this? It's superfluous. We've already been told that Yitzchak sent Yaakov away, and that Yaakov listened to his father and went to Padan Aram. On one level, the Pasuk is repeated because it's beginning to tell me the process of Yaakov becoming an independent entity. And it wants to give me this verse as a heading. The movement of Yaakov from Be'er Sheva to Haran is not only a geographical movement, it's an existential one. Be'er Sheva and Haran are polar opposites. What is Be'er Sheva to Yaakov? In last week's parsha, we saw that Be'er Sheva is the place where Yitzchak achieves his crowning success. In Be'er Sheva, Yitzchak is acknowledged by Avimelech as being the one who is blessed by God. As a result of that, Yitzchak is able to eat and drink and to reach a modus vivendi with Avimelech, to coexist. Yitzchak is able to then dig his wells. So that Be'er Sheva is the place where Yitzchak has achieved that sense of harmony with his environment and with God. For Yaakov, Be'er Sheva is the sense of a house, a home, a sense of intimacy. And now Yaakov is going to Haran. And I'd like to just say at this moment, Haran is a place which is hostile, which is alienating. A place where Yaakov has very real questions. Is God going to be there? If Be'er Sheva, or the larger area of the Negev, is where God is manifest in making the desert bloom, Haran seems to be the North Pole, where God is totally absent. We're told in Chapter 28, sentence 11, in the second verse, Vayifka b'makom vayalan sham ki vahashemesh, vayikach me'avnei ha'makom vayasem mera'ashotav, vayishkav b'makom ahu. That Jacob encounters the place. He lodges there because the sun has set. He takes the stones, places them around his head, and he goes to lie down in that place. The word vayifka is a very unusual word. It would have been much more appropriate to say that Jacob came to the place. In fact, even saying coming to the place is unusual, because what is this place? It's not the place of his destination. You have a very interesting rabbinic comment which says, on the basis of this verse, Jacob instituted Tfilat Arvit, the evening prayer, because it talks about Jacob lodging there after the sun has set. And the rabbis say, Vayifka is an expression of prayer based on a verse from Yirmiyahu. But what type of prayer is Vayifka? In modern Hebrew, the word paga means to hurt. Or unfortunately in Israel, we're too accustomed to the idea of a pigua, which is the word for a terrorist attack. Generally, translations say Vayifka b'makom means he encounters the place. But encountering could be understood in a painful way. And perhaps this is the nature of Yaakov's prayer. It's a very, very painful prayer. It's painful because it comes from a place of pain. Let me elaborate. Yaakov right now is running away from his brother who wants to kill him. Yaakov, for the first time, is leaving home. He's leaving a home which, as I said earlier, is a very safe, very welcoming environment. Yaakov has a tremendous amount of angst, anxiety. He's very, very unsure of what's awaiting him, very afraid. And perhaps one illustration of this is when he comes to this place and he lies down, he takes stones, places them around his head. And the simplest way of understanding this is that he's in a place where he's vulnerable. There are all kinds of wild animals around. By putting the stones around his head, it's trying to create some sort of insulating environment. And if Yaakov, in fact, is now encountering the place, and the place the rabbis understand to be a hint to God, it's an encounter which is very, very painful of someone who feels that he's perhaps being abandoned. He's being isolated. And then we find in the next verse it says, Vayachalom, he has a dream. V'hinei sulam mutzav artzav rosho magi ha-shamayma. There is a ladder which is firmly implanted on the ground and its head reaches the heavens. V'hinei malachei Elohim olim v'yordim bo. And there are angels of God who are going up and down the ladder. And then God, who is standing on top of the ladder, says to Jacob, Ani Hashem Elohei Avich, Avraham Avicha ve'Elohei Yitzchak. I am Hashem, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. And basically, God goes on to tell Jacob, I will give you the blessing which I have given your forefathers. You are the continuation of the covenant. But perhaps the most significant point which God says to him is in sentence 15. V'hine anochi imach, and behold, I am with you. Ushmarticha b'chol asher telech, and I will guard you wherever you will go. V'hashivoticha el ha'adama hazot, and I will return you to this land. Ki lo ezovcha, I will not leave you. Ad asher imasiti et asher dibarti lach, until I've done that which I have said to you. And just so that this is misunderstood, it's not God saying, oh, I'll be with you up to this point, but then afterwards I'll just drop you like a hot potato. But in fact, what God is saying to Yaakov is, I will never abandon you. I will always be with you. This is the most important message which Yaakov needs to hear. The sense that no matter where he goes, as lonely as it may seem, as far removed as his environment is from where he would like to be, God is there with him. And not only is God with him, but God will protect him. God will guarantee his survival. God will ensure that ultimately he will come back to the place where he needs to be. And we're told in the following verse, Vayikatz Yaakov Mishnato, and Yaakov wakes up from his sleep. Vayomer achen yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh. In fact, there is Hashem in this place. Va'anochi lo yadati, and I didn't know it. Vayira vayomar in the next verse, and he is in awe, and he says, Ma nora hamakom hazeh. How awesome is this place? Ein ze ki im beit Elohim v'ze shar hashamayim. This is none other than the house of God and the gate to heaven. Yaakov has an unbelievable revelation. The revelation is, God is in this place. But it's not only God is in this place. The revelation is, God can be found anywhere. And I'd even add, even in the places that are least likely, the ones you'd expect to find God. And Yaakov sees this as being awesome. The fact that God is not identified with a particular location, but that God can be found everywhere, for him is extremely comforting. With that promise, with that new understanding, Yaakov is able to now go on his journey. I would just like to add one other point in terms of the verses I just read. God appears to Yaakov in a dream. There's a dream in the beginning of the parsha, and there's a dream also at the end of the parsha. At the end of the parsha, God appears to him in a dream, and through an angel tells him, "Now's the time for you to go back." Yaakov tells that dream to his wives. Dreams are very important in the life of Yaakov. They're important because this is what enables him to confront and to overcome all the obstacles in his path. Yaakov's reality, and hopefully we'll be able to discuss this in the next few moments, is a reality which is very, very difficult, very painful. It's a reality which is overwhelming. It would be very easy for Yaakov to succumb to his reality and to be totally destroyed. For him to be able to not only survive, but to flourish, he has to have a dream which is going to help him to be able to overcome all those difficulties in his path. And he has dreams. And he does survive, and he eventually does come back. I would like to spend the next few moments looking at the encounters which Yaakov has in the parsha. And the first encounter that we have is in chapter 29, where Yaakov comes to this place, Charan, and he encounters a group of shepherds who were sitting around with their flocks. And perhaps with this feeling of empowerment now that God has told him, "I will be with you," Yaakov then goes to these people and starts to strike up a conversation. And the first thing which comes out of his mouth is to say to them, "My brethren, where are you from?" These aren't his brethren. These are just people who are hanging out. And yet Yaakov somehow feels, but I'm in this place and I want to feel at home. And so I address these people as my brothers. And when you look at the conversation, you see that it's a one-sided conversation. As much as Yaakov attempts to embrace them and to talk to them, their response are just one syllable. They have no interest whatsoever in befriending him, in being outgoing to him. In fact, there's a certain point where they say to him, when he asks, "Do you know about my uncle, Lavan?" So they say, "Yes, we do." And in fact, over there is his daughter, as a way of saying to Yaakov, "You know what, why don't you go bother her?" If I were in Yaakov's situation at this point, I would be totally devastated. I would feel, here I am. Okay, I tried to really embrace these people, and all the fears that I had of coming to a new place, coming to a place which is hostile, which is lonely, they're all true. They're all being actualized. Yet when Yaakov sees Rachel, all of a sudden, he takes on these superhuman qualities which have him take off this huge rock from the well, and he goes and he waters her sheep. And it's as if Yaakov now comes alive, because there's the hope, there's the dream. I've now finally found my family, and perhaps the woman who he will eventually marry. That's the first encounter which Yaakov has. But then we go to the next encounter, which is going to be the story of the whole parsha. And that is the relationship with his future father-in-law, Lavan. And if we look at sentence chapter 29, sentence 13, it seems to be wonderful. Lavan goes out when he hears the story, and he runs to Yaakov. He hugs him. He kisses him. He brings him into the house, and Yaakov tells him his whole story, although we don't know exactly what did Yaakov tell him. And then you would have the feeling, so look, all the fears which Yaakov has, there's no basis for. Because look at this home which he has now found. Look at how they're welcoming him in. And yet this warm welcome seems to be very, very short-lived. In fact, there's a question, and certainly the rabbis see that from the very outset, this was not a real welcome. From the very outset, this was just a charade. And the fact that Lavan is going out to Yaakov is just because he's trying to feel him out, to see where are his riches, because he wants to cash in on Yaakov. And then Lavan says to Yaakov, when he evidently does not find anything, any riches, "Ach atzmi v'sariyata," but you're my flesh and blood. There's a question, why say, but you're my flesh and blood? But evidently Lavan is not thrilled about seeing Yaakov, tries to maintain this facade, your family, but puts it in the way that makes it sound like, well, what can I do? Knows I'm stuck with you. You're my family, so I'll put up with you. And it says that Yaakov stays with him for a month. And then subsequently, Lavan comes to Yaakov and says to him, well, you're my brother, which sounds very, very nice. And how is it possible for you to work for me for nothing? So tell me your wages. Now, on the one hand, that sounds, you know, very, very nice, very reasonable. You're my brother. I don't want to take advantage of you. I want to be able to pay you for any work you do for me. On the other hand, we have to think for a moment that the whole reason why Yaakov came here was in order to find a wife, and specifically to find a wife from among the daughters of Lavan. And although the Torah doesn't say it, it would be very reasonable to assume that when Yaakov tells a story, he makes it very clear that that's why he's here. And yet never once does Lavan offer any of his daughters to Yaakov to be his wife. It's especially striking when I see a parallel story in the beginning of Shemot with Moses, who comes to a well and rescues these women from shepherds who are harassing them, and then is welcomed into the home of their father, Yitro, who takes the initiative and in the end asks Moses to marry his eldest daughter, Tzipporah. Yitro is a total outsider, and yet he welcomes Moshe into his home. In a similar story, you would have expected that Lavan should be welcoming Jacob into his home, and especially when Jacob tells him, I came here to find a wife, that he would be very happy to offer up one of his daughters. But we don't find that happening. Instead, Lavan engages in what we might call crass negotiations. So tell me your price. And this is the beginning, this sets the tone of the whole parsha, of Yaakov who has to learn to live with his father-in-law, who certainly, according to the rabbinic understanding, is a prime con artist, manipulator of the first degree, How does Yaakov survive in this type of environment? It's a very, very painful survival. And Yaakov, in fact, is taken advantage of many, many times. And perhaps for Yaakov, this is an unbelievable learning experience. What do you do when you're taken advantage of? How do you deal with it? Perhaps on the one hand, to try to anticipate in advance that possibility and try to do everything to avoid it. And then when it happens, how do I deal with it? I want to just note 2 points which I think are very important. Yaakov, when he's asked by Laban, tell me what your wages are, says, I'd like your daughter Rachel, and I'm willing to work 7 years. But he doesn't say just, I'd like your daughter Rachel. He says, Rachel bitcha haktana, your daughter Rachel, the youngest one. And the rabbis understand this to be Yaakov saying, I want to make it perfectly clear who it is that I want, so there's no misunderstanding, so that there's no room for deception, so that there's no way that you could switch and give me somebody else. I also am offering you 7 years of hard labor, which is a tremendous price to pay, so that in the end, you won't feel like you're being cheated. And we're told in the Pasuk that Yaakov does exactly as he said. And not only that, but the years go by like days because he's so in love with Rachel. And then when the time comes for Yaakov to get his side of the agreement, he comes to Laban and says, give me my wife. My time is up. And Laban's response is to gather a group, to make a party. Bottom line, he gives him the wrong woman. He gives him his eldest daughter, Leah. Without getting into the question of how did Yaakov not realize this, the morning after, Yaakov, when he finally does realize it, comes to Laban and says, what's going on here? You deceived me. And then Laban gives him this lame excuse, well, but we don't do things like this in our place. We don't give the youngest daughter before the eldest daughter. Why do I call it a deception? Because let's assume that that's really true. But why are you telling him now after the fact? Why didn't you tell him that 6-7 years ago? Why didn't you tell him that when he comes to you afterwards, the day before he gets married, and say, oh, by the way, you can't be getting Rachel. You're only getting Leah. There's no question that what happened here was a master deception. What's fascinating is that in the same breath, Laban then comes along and says to Yaakov, you know what? Okay, I'll give you the Rachel. Just work for me another 7 years. Without batting an eyelash. And Yaakov's response, which is very interesting, is, doesn't argue it, doesn't fight it, accepts it. And perhaps this is one formula that Yaakov has for surviving in this hostile environment. Let me just go with the punches. Let me just stay low profile. There's no way that I can stand up. There's no way that I can fight. So let me just take out whatever's dished out to me. But I want to just add another thing, which I think is critical in the parsha. Although Laban, and this is the beginning of that process, is constantly deceiving Yaakov, Yaakov has decided that he will create a standard of integrity which he will live by. No matter how much Laban deceives him, he will not play his game. He will not deceive Laban back. But he will be upfront with Laban, and if he is working for him, he will put in the full work that he needs to do. He will be the model employee. And this is very much to Yaakov's credit. In the 20 years that Yaakov spends by Laban, at the end of the parsha, he is able to say to Laban that my service to you was above and beyond reproach. I completely was devoted to you. Not only did I not abuse my service, did I take in any way advantage of my job, but I gave you everything. And in fact, in the Talmud, Yaakov's service of Laban is seen as a model to be emulated by any type of guardian. That's the good side of the picture. I want to conclude with a more problematic side. And the problematic side is that Yaakov has to learn how to stand up for himself. Yaakov has to learn how to be able to not just keep a low profile, survive, roll with the punches, but in fact to be able to stand up and say an injustice has been done, and this is what I think should be, to look the person straight in the face, and to tell them what you're doing is wrong and that you have to back down. This is perhaps Yaakov's problem in last week's parsha. Yaakov was not able to look at Esav and tell him, I should have the birthright. But he manipulates a situation. He extorts Esav when he's very, very hungry to sell him the birthright. By the same token, when his mother and he both feel that he should be getting the blessing, both Yaakov and his mother are unable to go to Yitzchak and say, give me the blessing, rather than my brother. And he has to do it in a very convoluted way. And this is also a problem that Yaakov has with Laban. When the time comes for Yaakov to leave, Yaakov is not able to go to Laban and say to him finally, I need to leave. The only time in this parsha where Yaakov's integrity is called into question is when Yaakov is leaving and it says, Vayignov Yaakov et lev Lavan. Yaakov stole the heart of Lavan, al blihi gidlo, in not telling him, kivoreachu, that he's running away. He runs away. He does not stand up and tell Lavan, it's been nice knowing you. I did my time. Now I want to go. When Laban finds out that Yaakov ran away, Laban runs after him. And it's only then, when Yaakov's back is against the wall, that Yaakov is able to then stand up to Laban and give him a whole speech, a whole accounting of what's been going on for the last 20 years. And when Yaakov does that, although Laban hems and haws, in the final analysis, Laban agrees to let him go and makes a pact with him. This is the learning experience of Yaakov by Laban. Yaakov needs to develop the quality of integrity. Yaakov needs to show that when he's in a hostile environment, an environment which is deceptive, he plays by different rules, and that he will bend over backwards to be a man of integrity. But Yaakov also needs to learn that there are situations where you can't just roll with the punches, but where you have to be able to stand up, to confront a situation, and to be able to stand proud and say, this is what I believe in, and I want you to acknowledge it. And when he does that, he triumphs. Laban, in the end, lets him go and makes a pact with him. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Please tell your friends about this podcast series, and please let us know your thoughts and comments. Send us email via podcast@pardesusa.org. Thanks to Dr. David Bernstein, the executive producer of Pardes from Jerusalem. Shalom and goodbye from Jerusalem.